I had faltered only a moment. But before another moment was over, my companion had seized the wheel and forced me to change places with him. The dusk was now very thick, and the lights of Portland far behind, so I could not see much of his face. The blaze of his eyes, though, was phenomenal, and I knew that he must now be in that queerly energized state, so unlike his usual self, which so many people had noticed. It seemed odd and incredible that listless Edward Derby, he who could never assert himself and who had never learned to drive, should be ordering me about and taking the wheel of my own car. Yet that was precisely what had happened. He did not speak for some time, and in my inexplicable horror, I was glad he did not. In the light of Biddeford and Saco, I saw his firmly set mouth and shivered at the blaze of his eyes. The people were right. He did look damnably like his wife, and like old Ephraim when in these moods. I did not wonder that the moods were disliked. There was certainly something unnatural in them. And I felt the sinister element all the more because of the wild ravings I had been hearing. This man, for all my lifelong knowledge of Edward Pickman Derby, was a stranger, an intrusion of some sort from the black abyss. He did not speak until we were on a dark stretch of road, and when he did, his voice seemed utterly unfamiliar. It was deeper, firmer, and more decisive than I had ever known it to be, while his accent and pronunciation was altogether changed, though vaguely, remotely, and rather disturbingly, recalling something I could not quite place. There was, I thought, a trace of very profound and very genuine irony in the timbre, not the flashy, meaningless, jaunty pseudo-irony of the callow sophisticate which Derby had habitually affected, but something grim, basic, pervasive, and potentially evil. I marveled at the self-possession so soon following the spell of panic-struck muttering. "I hope you'll forget my attack back there, Upton," he was saying. "You know what my nerves are, and I guess you can excuse such things. I'm enormously grateful, of course, for this lift home. And you must forget, too, any crazy things I may have been saying about my wife and about things in general. That's what comes from overstudy in a field like mine. My philosophy is full of bizarre concepts, and when the mind gets worn out, it cooks up all sorts of imaginary concrete applications. I shall take a rest from now on. You probably won't see me for some time, and you needn't blame Asneth for it. This trip was a bit queer, but it's really very simple. There are certain Indian relics in the North Woods, standing stones and all that, which mean a good deal in folklore, and Asneth and I are following that stuff up. It was a hard search, so I seem to have gone off my head. I must send somebody for my car when I get home. A month's relaxation will put me on my feet." I do not recall just what my own part of that conversation was, for the baffling alienage of my seatmate filled all my consciousness. With every moment, my feeling of elusive cosmic horror increased, till at length I was in a virtual delirium of longing for the end of the drive. Derby did not offer to relinquish the wheel, and I was glad of the speed with which Portsmouth and Newburyport flashed by. At the junction where the main highway runs inland and avoids Innsmouth, I was half afraid my driver would take the bleak shore road that goes through that damnable place. He did not, however, but darted rapidly past Rowley and Ipswich towards our destination. We reached Arkham before midnight and found all the lights still on at the old Crown and Shield house. Derby left the car with a hasty repetition of his thanks, and I drove home alone with a curious feeling of relief. It had been a terrible drive, all the more terrible because I could not quite tell why, and I did not regret Derby's forecast of a long absence from my company. The next 2 months were full of rumors. People spoke of seeing Derby more and more in his new energized state, and Asneth was scarcely ever in to her callers. I had only one visit from Edward, when he called briefly in Asnes' car, duly reclaimed from wherever he had left it in Maine, to get some books he had lent me. He was in his new state and paused only long enough for some evasively polite remarks. It was plain that he had nothing to discuss with me when in this condition, and I noticed that he did not even trouble to give the old 3-2 signal when ringing the doorbell. As on that evening in the car, I felt a faint, infinitely deep horror, which I could not explain, so that his swift departure was a prodigious relief. In mid-September, Derby was away for a week, and some of the decadent college set talked knowingly about the matter, hinting at the meeting with a notorious cult leader, lately expelled from England, who had established headquarters in New York. For my part, I could not get that strange ride from Maine out of my mind. The transformation I had witnessed had affected me profoundly, and I caught myself again and again trying to account for the thing, and for the extreme horror it had inspired in me. But the oddest rumors were those about the sobbing in the old Crown and Shelled house. The voice seemed to be a woman's, and some of the younger people thought it sounded like Asnes. It was heard only at rare intervals, and would sometimes be choked off as if by force. There was talk of an investigation, but this was dispelled one day when Asnes appeared in the street and chatted in a sprightly way with a large number of acquaintances, apologizing for her recent absence, and speaking, incidentally, about the nervous breakdown and hysteria of a guest from Boston. The guest was never seen, but Asnes' appearance left nothing to be said. And then someone complicated matters by whispering that the sobs had once or twice been a man's voice. One evening in mid-October, I heard the familiar 3-2 ring at the front door. Answering it myself, I found Edward on the steps and saw in a moment that his personality was the old one which I had not encountered since the day of his ravings on that terrible ride from Chesuncook. His face was twitching with a mixture of odd emotions, in which fear and triumph seemed to share dominion, and he looked furtively over his shoulder as I closed the door behind him. Following me clumsily to the study, he asked for some whiskey to steady his nerves. I forbore to question him, but waited till he felt like beginning whatever he wanted to say. At length, he ventured some information in a choking voice. "Asnes has gone, Dan. We had a long talk last night while the servants were out, and I made her promise to stop preying on me. Of course, I had certain occult defenses I never told you about. She had to give in, but got frightfully angry. Just packed up and started for New York. Walk right out to catch the 8:20 into Boston. I suppose people will talk, but I can't help that. You needn't mention that there was any trouble. Just say she's gone on a long research trip. She's probably going to stay with one of her horrible groups of devotees. I hope she'll go west and get a divorce. Anyway, I've made her promise to keep away and let me alone. It was horrible, Dan. She was stealing my body, crowding me out, making a prisoner of me. I lay low and pretended to let her do it. But I had to be on the watch. I could plan, if I was careful, for she can't read my mind literally or in detail. All she could read of my planning was a sort of general mood of rebellion, and she always thought I was helpless. Never thought I could get the best of her, but I had a spell or two that worked. Derby looked over his shoulder and took some more whiskey. I paid off those damn servants this morning. When they got back, they were ugly about it, and they asked questions, but they went. They're her kind, Innsmouth people, and we're hand in glove with her. I hope they'll let me alone. I don't like the way they laughed when they walked away. I, I must get as many of Dad's old servants again as I can. I'll move back home now. I suppose you think I'm crazy, Dan. But Arkham history ought to hint at things that back up what I've told you and what I'm going to tell you. You've seen one of the changes, too. In your car, after I told you about Asenath that day coming home from Maine, that was when she got me, drove me out of my body. The last thing I remember was when I was all worked up trying to tell you what that she-devil is. Then she got me. In a flash, I was back at the house, in the library, where those damn servants had me locked up in that cursed fiend's body that isn't even human. You know, it was she you must have ridden home with, that praying wolf in my body. You ought to have known the difference.
I shuddered as Derby paused. Surely I had known the difference. Yet could I accept an explanation as insane as this? But my distracted caller was growing even wilder.
I had to save myself. I had to, Dan. She'd have got me for good at Hallow Mass. They hold a Sabbat up there beyond Chesuncook, and a sacrifice would have clinched things. She'd have got me for good. She'd have been I, and I'd have been she forever. Too late. My body'd have been hers for good. She'd have been a man and fully human, just as she wanted to be. I suppose she'd have put me out of the way, killed her own body with me in it, just as she did before, just as it did before. Edward's face was now atrociously distorted, and he bent it uncomfortably close to mine as his voice fell to a whisper. You must know what I hinted in the car, that she isn't Asenath at all, but really old Ephraim himself. I suspected it a year and a half ago, and I know it now. Her handwriting shows it when she goes off guard. Sometimes she jots down a note in writing that's just like her father's manuscripts, stroke for stroke. And sometimes she says things that nobody but an old man like Ephraim could say. He changed forms with her when he felt death coming. She was the only one he could find with the right kind of brain and a weak enough will. He got her body permanently, just as she almost got mine, and then poisoned the old body he put her into. Haven't you seen old Ephraim's soul glaring out of that she-devil's eyes dozens of times, and out of mine when he has control of my body?
The whisperer was panting and paused for breath. I said nothing. And when he resumed, his voice was nearer normal. This, I reflected, was a case for the asylum. But I would not be the one to send him there. Perhaps time and freedom from Asenath would do its work. I could see that he would never wish to dabble in morbid occultism again.
I'll tell you more later. I must have a long rest now. I'll tell you something of the forbidden horrors she led me into. Something of the age-old horrors that even now are festering in out-of-the-way corners with a few monstrous priests to keep them alive. Some people know things about the universe that nobody ought to know, and can do things that nobody ought to be able to do. I've been in it up to my neck. But that's the end. Today, I'd burn that damn Necronomicon and all the rest if I were librarian and miskatonic. But she can't get me now. I must get out of that accursed house as soon as I can and settle down at home. You'll help me. I know if I need help. Those devilish servants, you know.
And if people should get too inquisitive about Asenath... You see, I can't give them her address. Then there are certain groups of searchers, certain cults, you know, that might misunderstand our breaking up. Some of them have damnably curious ideas and methods. I know you'll stand by me if anything happens, even if I have to tell you a lot that will shock you.